Hey everyone, it's Brandon here. Welcome to season 2 of Audacity of This Pitch. This season focused on basically, you know, musicians among us, artists among us. At the end of the season, I wanted to give a sneak preview of season 3, which is basically going to be the sound of leadership. We're going to be hearing from leaders all across Duke and how they think and move when it pertains to diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging in their spaces of governance. Our first guest, Ian Brown, supervises the affinity groups on the medical side. So I want to give you a trigger warning. During my discussion with Ian Brown this morning, I made a mistake and used the word wife beater in reference to a t-shirt. And I was going to edit it out, but I thought there was an ideal opportunity to showcase Ian Brown's leadership in correcting me in this space. And I thought it would make good content. So I'm going to be a little bit vulnerable. I said I was going to edit that part out, but I'm going to leave it in because as we are talking about leadership in the sound of leadership, I want you to hear what leadership actually looks like, sounds like, moves like. I want you to experience that. That's the beauty of this particular podcast product. You get authenticity. So, trigger warning, the word wife beater, you know, remains in this edit, but there's intention behind it. And I want you to know I'm a flawed human being. We're all flawed human beings. And we're moving in this space trying to figure out things together and trying to figure out how to counter those negative aspects of our programming and reinforce the positive aspects that help us to validate and support one another. So, with no further ado, thank you for listening to The Audacity of This Pitch, Season 2. And I'm going to make this last episode the first episode. Stick with us for Season 3. Hope you enjoy.
The Audacity of This Pitch.
The Audacity of This Pitch has been brought to you by Diversify IT.
We're getting ready to go into season 3 of Audacity of This Pitch. So season 2 featured like the music talent among us, right? And so like every season I've been trying to come up with like, you know, a new theme. Myself and Chris Derrickson, we talk about like, you know, what the theme is going to be for, you know, that season. And the next season, I want to do the sound of leadership. Like, what leaders at Duke, you know, listen to, but using that as a gateway to insight about how leadership operates and also how it interacts with, you know, the community at large, right? A different perspective. Like, we see the formal, like, you know, administrative, you know, appearance of leadership on a regular basis whenever we're dealing with them, you know, in regard to supervisory responsibilities and what we're assigned to do as employees of Duke. But yeah, like the Audacity of This Pitch has specialized in showing a different side of the community here. That makes us more human and less, you know, focused on like work. And I don't want to sound professorial or whatever, but yeah, I'm like hearing myself and I'm like listening to audio quality at the same time as I'm explaining this to you. And I'm also recording this part right here because every single episode starts a little bit of like back and forth banter where we're like, you know, trying to, you know, build a rapport as we're talking and
then it just evolves into it.
And that's
how
I want
to. So how did you get into this? So I guess I'm interviewing you now.
So
tell me a little bit about you.
Okay. No, well, yeah. So here's the whole situation. You know, and without going back too far, I was born and raised in Kansas, and being black in Kansas, and also now I'm recently diagnosed like autistic, and I didn't recognize what I didn't know I was autistic back then or whatever.
Oh, wow.
I was on the outside and very observant of like how people interacted with one another because I couldn't participate completely because you're black in the Midwest, right? So I'm able to like play with my peers and socialize with my friends, play with my peers in grade school and socialize with my friends like in high school and whatnot. But I was always like on the outside. And
Brandon, how did that make you feel? Thinking about it from a DEIB standpoint, mm-hmm. the idea of being an outsider, how did that make you really, really feel?
Naturally, it made me feel, it made me feel excluded. Mm-hmm. And it also made me question my role, in the community. Like whenever you're like, outcast. I don't want to say like I never had any friends growing up or whatever, because I had some friends, growing up, and ironically a lot of them were, more neurodivergent, like me. But as far as like fitting into general spaces like, the high school community and whatnot, I was considered an outsider. And at first, look, to answer your question, you take it personally because you're like, what's wrong with me? I have ideas, I have opinions, I'm bringing stuff to the table, I have every right to critique how things are moving, just like everybody else is able to critique and talk about how things are moving. Mm-hmm. I felt outside, but at the same time, being on the outside gave me an objective perspective when it came to how the group was moving as a whole. When you're outside the herd, you can be like, the herd's moving toward a cliff. This doesn't make sense. And so I say that to say what ended up happening in all these spaces where I was, every so often you'll have a couple people like fall off the herd, and then they'll come and be like, hey, Brandon, I have this problem. I'm going through this situation. It started in high school. Like, friends come to me. I'm going through a situation with my friend at work or whatever, or I'm going through a situation with my girlfriend or whatever, and people are just coming to me to consult. And then they made me, in high school, a peer mediator, where I'm sitting here, negotiating, differences. It was like a pilot program.
Were you good at it?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
People were able to trust you. And
exactly.
Felt that you were being fair and equitable.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
And also, you were able to get at the truth of what was going on.
Yeah.
We're in Kansas.
Topeka.
Where is that in relation to like Kansas City? I don't know.
It is about an hour and a half from Kansas City. Yeah. We used to go to Kansas City on a regular basis for my mom to get her hair done.
Okay. So, wow.
On Sunday. So, on the weekends.
Was that because of just really where the population was that?
Primarily, I could do her hair. That's the thing. It's like, she couldn't find anybody in Topeka who could do her hair. Unless, she went to, a friend's house. It wasn't, a licensed, beautician.
So was that where your mother grew up? Or
no, my mom was actually from here in North Carolina, a little place called Red Springs.
What took you guys there?
To see
Dorothy?
What actually took us there is my mom and dad both met at Winston-Salem State University. And every single time people hear I'm from Kansas, it's a Wizard of Oz joke sneaks in. They met at Winston-Salem State University. My dad got a scholarship to the University of Kansas, and that's for law school. And that's where, he got admitted into law school. He already had a scholarship at Winston-Salem State University, but he got admitted into law school at the University of Kansas. And yeah, that's where they raised their family. So after he graduated in Lawrence, he started his own practice. He was a public defender in Topeka for a little bit, and then started his own practice and raised my sister and I there.
Nice. Winston-Salem. Is that where Carlton went to school? Carlton Brunson?
Yeah, Carlton Brunson. Yeah, okay, mm-hmm. Carlton. He's a Ram, too.
Yeah,
he's a Ram, too.
Our buddy Carlton.
We just had an album.
Did you go there? Where did you go?
I went to Winston-Salem State, yeah.
So you followed your family right there?
Yeah.
And that's HBCU, right?
Yeah, that's HBCU. And then,
is that one of the Divine Nine?
Not that I know. No, I mean, when you talk about Divine Nine, you're talking about
Howard.
I don't know about the Divine Nine.
Or is it the Greek?
The Greek fraternities and sorority. Yeah, I had never heard of Divine Nine. But I know there's like some black colleges that are regarded as like the Ivy League black colleges.
Got it. I like the Converse.
Oh, thank you.
High top.
Thank you. These are my signature shoe. They're very, very comfortable. And yes. And you can change them up and not have to worry about breaking your bank account.
So you have different colors?
Yeah. I keep different colors because I like to coordinate with different outfits, and these are very economical for doing so. And they're also very, very classic.
I like them. They're pretty classic.
Thank you. So, roundabout way, that's how I got into diversity and equity work at a young age, and like every institution that I've been at, since high school, college, I've always sat on, some kind of organization that involved people some way, somehow. What is that?
I played some Bob Marley in the meantime. do you like Bob Marley?
Yes, I do like Bob Marley. So that brings me to you, Ian. What is your this is I assume your music is inspired. Where are you from? Let's talk about this. Because the Bob Marley, I believe, is connected.
Listen, in the diversity world, you don't ask people where they're from.
Oh, what's eating? This is true. You're assuming, sir.
You're assuming. You're making an assumption about me.
You're very well poised and whatnot. But I also there's a slight lilt in your speech that lets me know that you may not be from around these parts.
So you want to know where I'm from? Listen to this music here.
Okay.
Feel it.
I can feel it. I feel the Caribbean vibes. We're talking Jamaica.
Yeah, Bob Marley. Mm-hmm. I just love this one.
Mm-hmm.
I wanna love you.
That's what's up.
Day and every night.
Yes, I'm feeling this.
Together. I love Bob Marley. I grew up with Bob Marley's music. He had such an amazing way of telling story from had such grace in connecting and talking about the impact that all of us can come together.
Facts.
It's like one of the songs, "No Woman, No Cry." Mm-hmm. And of course, the Redemption song. Mm-hmm. I mean, just all of those songs that kind of come together to talk about the amazing story of humanity, and that all of us, no matter where we are from, have a soul, have a sense of a purpose, and that. But that our own selves, all of us together, I alone can't do it. Mm-hmm. You
connection.
Alone can't do it.
So we need
the connections. Yes, the relationships matter, and that's why I think. That's why I really get drawn to his story and the many other stories that he tells as well. So music is really important to me, and Bob Marley's also one of the. So much out of music, and he says too that music is is one of those languages that everybody speaks.
Mm-hmm.
You listen to the music, and there's something about the music that makes you start to kind of move and, mm-hmm. and you know, so all of us can do that. And it doesn't matter how you move, you know, mm-hmm. it's like, mm-hmm. and it's like the journey around diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging. When I talk about belonging, it's like dancing like no one's watching.
Mm-hmm.
So it's
mm-hmm.
it's a language, it's a story of the song
mm-hmm.
that connects all of us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And yeah, whenever when you're talking about diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging, especially whenever you like, you know, juxtapose that against, you know, Bob Marley's, you know, legacy, you're talking about, like, you know, people moving naturally as their natural selves. Like, that's what music compels you to do. Like, you know, you start moving, you're not like, you know, if you're dancing freely, mm-hmm. you're not wondering like, you know, is anybody looking at me? I sure hope I'm moving my left leg right. No, when you feel comfortable in yourself, when you're able to be yourself, you move in your way. And there's no wrong way to do that. And you're secure in that.
Exactly. You gotta be secure in that. And, you know, part of it too is that Bob Marley's story is that here's a guy who grew up in essentially the ghetto in Kingston, Jamaica,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, and got a break mm-hmm. to doing something, which I got a break in my own life as well. I mean, you know a little bit about my story. I grew up in Jamaica. I grew up in a fairly poor family and got an opportunity to come to this country and, you know, you know, there's the other side of Jamaica, too, which is a lot of folks who say Jamaica is a really very homophobic country.
Mm-hmm.
People can't be truly who they are there, be their authentic selves. And there's a lot of that there still.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
I keep telling myself, Brandon, that if I won the lottery, mm-hmm. that's one of the things that I would do. I'd probably go, probably get an airplane or hire an airplane that goes and spread all kind of messages across Jamaica and say, hey, stop thinking this way.
Facts.
Stop thinking this way. You know, let people be who they truly are.
Mm-hmm.
So I got this opportunity to come to this country and, you know, and was able to come out as a gay man and, you know, as a teen. And, you know, part of that, too, was the struggle in this country. I mean, America is a place where we can be who we are, but there are also challenges with that as well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because even coming out as gay in this country, there was a family that I was staying with just didn't know what to do with that. So so I got a one-way ticket back to Jamaica, and I ended up...
Man.
Yeah, it was a one-way ticket, but it had a stopover in Miami. You know, at 16 years old, I got off the plane.
Uh-huh.
It's like, where was I going? What was I thinking? And and I ended up taking a cab downtown Miami on Biscayne Boulevard. I remember it so vividly. And I remember walking into, walking on the streets and asking people what I, you know, is there a place where I could find some help as a kid? And I don't know where I found the courage to do that, but maybe it's the faith experience that I had, because I also grew up with a really strong faith in Jamaica as well. And people connected me and told me where I could go. I went to a place called Camilla's House in Miami. It's a homeless shelter.
Mm.
And I remember this French-Canadian monk, Brother René Chenier, and I got to reach out to him because every so often we talk, but I think he moved back to Canada, to Quebec.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember him coming to the gates of the shelter and looking at me and said, why are you here? Why are you here? And I was actually, it was my best outfit that I had, so I had it on. And he said, you're not going to survive out there.
Mm-hmm.
And he opened the gates and let me in, and you know, that's my story. I lived there for a few months. I got to meet some amazing people, a woman by the name of Elnita Sinclair.
Mm.
Elnita, if you're out there and hearing some of this podcast, I'm here because of you. She connected me to her family in New York, and they put me up. I got the opportunity to finish school, and including college and all of that stuff. And, you know, Brandon, here I am. And I always say,
mm-hmm.
there but for the grace of God go I.
Yes.
There but for the grace of God go I. Because, you know, and that's why I try so hard not to judge people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. I see homeless people on the street, and, again, I always say that, but for the grace of God go I. Mm-hmm. We don't know what people's circumstances are.
Facts.
You know, we don't know what they are. Mm-hmm. We don't know what got someone to be in a place like that. Mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. I've learned over the years that, you know, and one of the things that my mother always say to me is that I must learn always to forgive. Mm-hmm. Forgiveness is such an important thing. But forgiveness comes from your own getting to know yourself, being self-aware. Mm-hmm. And it goes to these principles that I talk about and I try to model in the ideas around inclusive leadership, which when you are self-aware, Brandon, mm-hmm. it makes you willing to be vulnerable.
Facts. It's inevitable.
And yeah. You know, mm-hmm. it's like, you know, which is why, you know, I try to get to know myself. Mm-hmm. And it's through knowing myself that I'm able to say, hey, this is who I am. Mm-hmm. Being vulnerable, sharing it with folks, because it enables me to have the empathy mm-hmm. and the compassion and the inviting of different perspectives to the table. And that's why I love the work that I'm doing here at Duke with you mm-hmm. as a partner and others in this amazing journey that we're on. And mm-hmm. it's a journey.
Facts.
Because, you know what, I mean, if I go there to Brandon and tell everybody I know everything about diversity, mm-hmm. tell everybody that I know everything about diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging, even as I am leading that function here, mm-hmm. I want people to come up to me and say, Ian, you're lying, because it wouldn't be true, because mm-hmm. this discipline and this field is forever evolving. Mm-hmm. We're learning something new every single day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, there's so many different cultures. I mean, you were talking, you know, about your mom, mm-hmm. And you know, the influence, you know, on your identity, you know, about, you know, caring for people, like, you know, growing up in a religious, you know, family. I remember mm-hmm. my mother was extremely, you know, religious too, conservative. Grew up, you know, like I said, rural North Carolina and everything. And then whenever we went to Kansas, or whenever she moved to Kansas, you know, I was raised in the AME church. And so, yeah, like, understanding community, understanding, you know, how we're all connected is part of, you know, our religious belief system, mm-hmm. right? Like, I mean, that's the foundation of belief, is you are working with a group of people toward a common objective of making the body whole. And so my mom, she embodied that as a high school teacher. She took me out on a regular basis and she was showing me, like, you know, hey, you know, these are students that I teach at school in this formal setting, but I'm volunteering my time to take them to the zoo. You know, because their parents don't have time, you know, mm-hmm. to do it, to give them cultural experiences, you know, so they can see how we're all interconnected, even though we're all, you know, different, mm-hmm. right? And so that theme of intersectionality is pervasive when it comes to this diversity, equity, and inclusion work. Like, even though I have no idea what it's like to grow up in Jamaica. I don't know. I have no idea what it's like to, you know, live life openly as a gay man. I have no idea what it's like to be a mom at Duke. I have no idea what it's like to be part of the Asian American Pacific Islander community, right? And so only by hearing stories and interacting with all these different people do I understand the commonalities that exist in regard to our relative struggles and how we can work together to accomplish them.
Well, you know, that's a great point you're making, because as I think about it and I think about the many intersectionalities that I bring, I'm a black man, I'm an mm-hmm. immigrant, I was once undocumented, I mean, I was homeless, I'm a married gay man, you know, I grew up as an Episcopalian, mm-hmm. in the islands we call it Anglicanism, mm-hmm. and all of that, so... You know, I mean, there are all these intersectionalities. And one of the things that we often talk about in terms of diversity, the idea around diversity is that it's about difference. Mm. Difference. But I love the way that you talk about it, because you talk about, the differences that we bring. Mm-hmm. But the engagement with the other groups drives the intentional opportunities to seek mm-hmm. commonalities. Mm-hmm. Because mm-hmm. when, you know, I see you as a huge part of the AAPI group, mm. I don't believe you are AAPI.
No.
You're
at all.
Yeah, exactly. But you're so connected to that group, mm-hmm. and it's how we create these partnerships and these collaborations mm-hmm. that enables us to thrive and to better relate to one another and to create the kind of dialogue mm-hmm. that invites perspectives and that makes us better. I mean, we use the term here that we want always to seek mm-hmm. to become better versions of ourselves. Mm-hmm, 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 mm-hmm. And that's what we seek to do when we go and meet with the various affinity groups, whether it's Blacktivate mm-hmm. And the amazing people who are part of that, to the Duke Military Association and mm-hmm. and the connections there. And even within those groups, mm-hmm. I mean, you can't assume that every black man is the same.
Exactly.
It's
exactly.
Like, you know,
exactly.
You know, Brandon, you and I here talking exactly. about. It's like, you know, I mean, you don't know. You didn't grow up as a gay man.
No. Well,
you know, so that's not you. Mm-hmm. But that's my experience. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, I don't know what it's like to be a straight guy. Mm-hmm, you know what mm-hmm. I mean?
But you're right, and that's what, and it's we're both black men in America. Mm-hmm. Right? So we have a commonality.
Yeah.
So we can understand nuance better because of the fact that, you know, we have this commonality. What are those slight differences in our experiences that define, you know, how we see the world? It's easier for us to identify those because it's like, you know, I see I've been through this, you know, I went to church. This is how my mom, you know, raised me or whatever. So, but I can understand you more yeah. because we have that baseline.
Yeah.
And yeah. that the understanding of the nuance is where the intersectionality exists. And then we can use that intersectionality to connect with other groups that are outside yeah, of our yeah. collective, our united experience.
Yeah, you know, it's great. And, you know, I mean, we talk about even the other groups that have been formed, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, that mm-hmm. have formed mm-hmm. here at Duke Moms. Mm-hmm. I mean, we guys, we don't know what it's like to be a mom. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, we see it in the experience of people who were our moms, mm-hmm. who model those kind of really great attributes.
Facts.
And, I mean, with the exception of someone like Bill Cosby, who played a mom.
True. There's that.
There's that. Remember that?
Yeah.
So, you know, and you know, so we connect to those stories. Mm-hmm. And our striving is to create the environment where those groups are formed mm-hmm. and shape or model behaviors for us to be able to see mm-hmm. how we can connect and be better in forming relationships with those constituents across the enterprise.
One of my, when I was working on, you mentioned the AAPI earlier, and, you know, the close relationship I built with them, in all honesty, like, in that relationship was built as an extension of the relationship I built in Diversify IT with mm-hmm. the chair and founder of, you know, AAPI, or one of the founders, because they govern by consensus there. But Rebecca Lee.
I love Rebecca. Everybody loves Rebecca.
But yeah, so I mean, like, you know, Rebecca was in Diversify IT, and she was like, you know, I wanted to, you know, I want to continue doing this work or whatever. But, you know, she felt like, you know, after the March 16, 2021 Atlanta spa shootings, like, they needed to have a space that was for the AAPI community to talk about these issues, just like, you know, basically there was an insurgence of, you know, individuals who were all about discussing George Floyd, you know, in Diversify IT. And so she saw that in Diversify IT, but then, you know, she saw that Diversify IT wasn't going to be dedicated to focusing on, you know, just those issues, and felt like that space had to be created. And so, you know, she and I were like, you know, okay, we'll maintain this contact, we'll maintain this friendship, because she saw me doing more in Diversify IT. And I was like, you know, whenever you need me to help platform, get you out there or whatever, like, Diversify IT Communications has you. And so she solicited, you know, the art piece for us to make. But one thing that I discovered during the fabrication piece of the art outside of interacting with the community. The most interesting I had a lot of interesting conversations. That's the beautiful thing about how the art is created, by going to all these different locations and on these people talking with one another. That's one thing. But during the fabrication process, when I was cutting the piece, at one of my woodworking friends' carpentry workshops, he stated, I was telling him about the experience and basically how working with AAPI and how all these different diversity, equity, and inclusion works, you know, work together toward different goals and collaborate. He was like, yeah, it's like your art. It's like an emergent property. That's what he called it. It's an emergent property. The collaboration is something that, you know, when you're talking about metal and galvanizing metal and making metal stronger, you take iron and combine it with steel, and you create a stronger metal that has the characteristics of both, right? And that's what I see in regard to like intersectionality and working between groups and working with building relationships with AAPI, Black Divinity, and whatnot.
Yeah, I mean, and I sense it in even the steering committee leads coming together when we meet on a monthly basis to kind of share ideas and talk about how we connect, how we create the environment where we support each other. Mm-hmm. I mean, when George Floyd was murdered, and it coalesced around this whole idea of moments to movement. And Duke did an amazing job in bringing people together from Dr. Washington and Rhonda and all the other folks who were involved in that, in pulling people together to do the march and to creating the Duke Pledge against racism. It's a similar experience when you start having hate in the AAPI community. How do we coalesce around that? In essence, to say those things are unacceptable and should be unacceptable in our world. How do we create intentionality around the same thing when we're talking about trans rights? Those things were gay rights. The same thing when we're talking about anti-Semitism and all of those topics and Islamophobia and things like that. I think it's really important for us as we begin to dig deeper into some of these issues to continually and be consistent in our approach in saying that these isms are unacceptable. And we as team members should focus intently in making sure that we do everything that we can to eradicate those things, to get rid of them. They should, every human has something redeemable about them. We get conditioned into certain ways, and it's unfortunate that we get moved. We learn to behave in some ugly ways, and to the extent that from a DEI&B standpoint, that we can have an impact in letting people know that as humans we can work hard to live together and be one. It's, you know, but you know, Brandon, it's easier said than done.
I mean, it's always, well, first of all,
I mean, it's here I'm talking aspirationally about all of this stuff, but I aspire for that.
But that's it. It's a journey, right? It's not a destination. Like that we were talking earlier about, you know, how, I mean, the culture of this space and the work that we're doing. And it's not, we're part of, for me, we're part of a greater arc through history. Like, you know, the advocating for these different marginalized groups is not new, right? It's been done before in other places. We are in this professional space doing the same thing, doing the same work. And so thusly, we can take lessons from other individuals like Bob Marley, case in point.
Yeah.
Right. And use that, you know, to build the relationships, you know, between each other. That's necessary for us to move forward together.
Yeah, it's like, you know, it's Bob Marley. It's you know, I adored Whitney Houston, and you know, Mariah Carey's still here, and then, you know, it's these are people that I actually, in terms of the music that they had, that kind of inspired me in terms of some of the what they sang, how they sang it, and all of that stuff. I mean, have you ever heard Whitney and Mariah sing "When You Believe"?
Yes, I have.
Oh my God, that's like, that is such an amazing song.
You will win.
Because, you know, part of it is that you got to believe something. You got to believe, even when we talk about diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging, you can't be in this thing if you don't believe that there are possibilities.
Facts.
That you got to aspire to some of this song.
Exactly.
And these women are just amazing. They're amazing. But these are the kind of songs that, you know, I grew up listening to. I remember when Thriller came out. I actually saw MJ the other day at the MJ the Musical at DPAC.
Okay,
it was like amazing.
It was okay.
It was like the guy who did it. He's actually from I moved here from the DC area, and the lead, the guy who was the who played Michael, was from Prince George's County.
Okay.
County right outside of DC, and it was so phenomenal. But you know, I remember when Thriller came out and the craziness around that song during Halloween and all of that. And then, of course, you know, Michael Jackson doing the Moonwalk.
Iconic,
right? Did you ever do it?
I did it. Yeah, I had a glove.
Were you
I had a glove. I had a glove, and I had patent leather Sunday shoes. Patent leather Sunday shoes. Penny loafers, actually. Penny loafers. They had pennies in them. See, so that's how I know you were official. So, yeah, I had my glove and that.
And did you have the white socks too?
You always had some white socks. You always had some white. Everybody had a little trusty pair of white. It was the easiest. Once you got the glove, you were set. You had to get the glove, and then you just had to get a nice little fedora too if you want to throw it, maybe a red leather jacket if you really wanted to push the limits. But yeah, you know, doing Michael Jackson, all you really needed was a pair of jeans, put your white socks, you know, over your jeans, crouch it down a little bit, penny loafers, and, you know, maybe like, you know, a white wife beater shirt or, you know, t-shirt or whatever, like that thing.
Yeah, you gotta. I don't like that term, white.
Exactly, you know, I said it, and I was like,
say, "Come on, Brandon, say, we're not gonna say that word."
I will cut that out. That's how I correct myself. And you'll put on a white T-shirt. That's what you will put on. You will put on a white T-shirt, A-line, maybe something. But yeah, that I will fix that.
You better fix that,
Peter. Get that, Peter.
But also to gosh, you know, when the AIDS epidemic was going on, and you got Quincy Jones and Michael Jackson, Dionne Warwick, and all these guys coming out, and what's the name of that song that they
We Are the World.
We Are the World.
We Are the World.
We Are the World.
We Are
and
the
that's
World.
That's the other song that really kind of inspired me as well in terms of this work and the fact that even when something like that was going on, and you had a group of people, powerful people, kind of coalescing around a vision to help people be better. I mean, it's you know, for Africa, I mean, when you saw the famine that was going on in Africa too, it's all about that, helping people. Lionel Richards. There you go. There you go, Brandon. Sing it. Oh my gosh.
But no, like, this is so iconic because I remember this song came out, like, you know, choirs were singing it, you know, like everybody, like it was a testament to how music can connect us. All these famous people singing and everything, you know, Bruce Springsteen,
Kenny
voices.
Rogers.
Exactly, like, voices like, where you like, strong voices.
It's like, it's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And you have all these powerful people coming together and saying, you know, we got to solve world hunger.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
food insecurity is a big issue here in Durham.
Mm-hmm.
We got to
mm-hmm.
figure that out.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of
mm-hmm.
folks in Durham don't have health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
Health equity is a big issue. So we got to figure that out, too.
Mm-hmm.
And so the work is, as you're talking about, it's a journey that we're all on.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can make a dent in some of the work that we're in, some of the things that we're doing,
mm-hmm.
To impact people's lives, to help people, we can share our gifts to create communities that celebrate life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We can do that. And all of us have gifts that we can share, mm-hmm. no matter what we look like, where we work, we have something that we can give that can impact somebody else's life.
And affirm each other. And affirm each other, too, because, you know, these spaces, you were talking about these isms earlier. Yeah, you know, if you're, you know, racism is definitely going to be something that Black Debate is going to want to address wherever it arises. So
yeah.
We all become vanguards in mm-hmm. these different spaces, these different affinity groups, not only, you know, inform the community about the issues, support each other, but yeah, they also are vanguards and they can say, you know what, this thing that's happening, you know, in this immediate area of influence that we all share is homophobic. This thing is transphobic. This thing is misogynist. And they can call each other out, just like I made that statement right there earlier or whatever, which I am going to cut out. You were able to say.
But I think it's mm-hmm. really important, Brandon, that we know ourselves. Because when
True.
We know ourselves, we're able to then say, hey, it brings out the courage in us to be able to say, hey, you know what? I made a mistake.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and if I can
mm-hmm.
say I made a mistake, I then need to look at you when you make a mistake and say, hey, did you mean to say that?
Exactly. You know? And we can be confident if we're coming to the table in this space. This is one of the things I love about the affinity groups is you have individuals who are coming together in a space that's outside of, you know, your assigned business duties, right? You're coming here to talk about culture and community. You can comfortably make those mistakes and be educated about them
exactly.
in these spaces.
Exactly. And, you know, I have a very simple line in a few words in terms of how I define culture.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I always say that culture is the way I behave. Culture is the way I, Ian Brown, behaves,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
plus how I allow you, Brandon, to behave.
Mm-hmm. In my presence. Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm. if I see you out there saying something that's inappropriate and I allow you to continue to do that without
mm-hmm.
calling you out,
mm-hmm.
then that is the culture that we're creating within the environment in which we live.
Mm-hmm. If you don't call me out, you are also, I have set the tone. I have set the culture. If I've said something, you know, bigoted, you know, and you don't say something,
yeah.
you are basically saying, especially if you're in a position of leadership, since it's supposed to be about, you know, the sound of leadership, if you were there and you witness something that you know was untoward, you know, in regard to the betterment of the entire community, and you don't say something, you are affirming that culture in your silence.
Yeah, it's the same. It's, you know, it goes back to, it's the same as a leader or anyone walking down the hallway of the Central Tower
mm-hmm.
and passing someone in the hallway and not say hello.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, because we get so consumed in the world in which we are. Maybe get stuck on our cell phones.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how do we create that environment where we can look someone in the eye and say, hey, good morning,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
you know, and mean it when we say good morning,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
smile,
mm-hmm.
or the other, you know, I always say this too, is that you walk down the hallway and you see piece of trash and you just walk by it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's the culture we create because we assume that, well, somebody else is going to come and pick it up.
Yeah,
because,
yeah.
you know, it's like, you know, so when we pass down the hallway and we see something, we pick it up and, you know, as appropriate as we can and go back and wash our hands. If it's something that we believe that could get us sick, then we probably need to get somebody who's properly trained to do that. But, I mean, there's nothing wrong with us pausing and picking up a piece of tissue that's on the floor because we want the best environment for all of us. And so how do we create that culture? It is working with people, all of us together, to create that environment that enables the employee experience to be the best one for all of us. And those are the kind of things that I am passionate about in supporting this organization, Duke University Health System, in our efforts to be able to build that culture.
Well, one of the through lines that I've seen between all the affinity groups is a collective willingness to address the culture, like, you know, in their own unique way and perspective and vantage point based off of their identities. And you use that metaphor about walking down the hall and passing a piece of trash. And the main reason, like, 90% of people won't pick up that trash in is because in their mind they're thinking to themselves, like you said, you know, somebody else will get that. More importantly, that's not what I do.
It's not my job.
That's not my job. That's not my responsibility, right? Even though we know if enough trash, you know, piles up in that hallway, you can't walk through it.
And nobody's going to want to work here.
No one's going to want to work here.
Nobody's going to want, no patient is going to want to come here.
Now you're getting sick. You know, no, this is not a place, but it's not your job, right? And so, but you're willing to work among filth because it's not your job. And that's the culture. And then now you're wondering, like, you know, like you said, why is this business failing? Why can I not do my job properly? And that's the thing I love about the affinity groups is everybody compulsory in their participation. Everybody compulsory in their participation saying, this is what I do.
Right.
And together, this is what we do.
Right.
Right.
Right. And you know, and it's not to say that in our efforts, in our business, in a day-to-day basis, we're going to be consumed by all kinds of stuff going on around us. We're going to make mistakes along the way.
Exactly. We're human.
And, yeah. And part of it, too, is that as we make mistakes, part of this journey is to admit to the mistakes that we make, a willingness to say, you know, I mean, I'm willing to change. And especially, you know, when you talk about even on the DIB lens, bias. We all have biases. And I think the best way to overcome a bias is to accept that we have the bias and a willingness to work on it, to
We've
adjust.
We've all been groomed towards something.
Yeah.
Got you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, to the extent that I can be a partner with you, Brendan, in this work, continue to do that. I'm excited.
I am too.
I'm excited
about this conversation. This made me that much more excited.
Yeah. It's. You know, as I said, I bring all of me to the work. You know, I won't deny any part of who I am as a human because that's what makes me the guy that I am today.
And it makes you a beautiful person. And that's what we need. You have to be, if you're going to be a leader in this space, authenticity has to come first because people are not only trusting you, but because they're trusting you with their beliefs and their efforts, their volunteer efforts toward, you know, addressing, you know, the issues that are relevant to them. They've got to know that they are dealing with somebody who is sincere.
Yeah.
You know, and sincerity, you know, is transparent, you know, whenever you're moving authentically.
Yeah. And, you know, you're right. And, you know, I'll end with this. I have my 13-year-old nephew, Antoine, who's living with us. And he's a really cool kid. He moved here from Jamaica July 22nd, and he's now in school. He goes to Durham Nativity School. And I shared the story about a week ago with the HR Rhonda's group, weekly Thursday group, where we come and share gratitude. And this is we're in the midst of the season of gratitude. Tomorrow's Thanksgiving. So I can't do this without a moment of gratitude in that my nephew Antoine, and he goes to this all boys school. He's in eighth grade, and they all get the opportunity to do chapel. And here's this kid who a few days before his speech, he comes up to me and he says, "Uncle Ian, I have this quote that I need to write a speech on." And I said, "Antoine, when are you doing this speech?" He said, "In a couple of days." And I said, "Are you just coming to me now?" So he jumps out, "Antoine, geez, seriously?
As students do.
Yeah, you got to give me a little bit more time to process it." So what are you thinking of you're going to say? Mm-hmm. The quote that he actually got was a quote from the Roman orator Cicero. Mm-hmm. And the quote is, "Gratitude is not only the greatest of all virtues, mm-hmm. but it is the parent of all of them." Mm-hmm. And you know, I'm saying that to say anything. He did a really great job in writing the speech and also presenting it. Got some nice feedback from the teachers when he presented it in the morning on a Thursday morning. And I'm just saying gratitude because I'm so grateful for all the folks who work in the affinity groups who are supporting the cause of advancing diversity. Mm-hmm. I'm so grateful to the health system for the opportunity to lead this function, mm-hmm. the function of employee experience, and the connecting the DEI&B strategy to it, because the DEI&B strategy can't be a strategy unto itself. It has to be a strategy around culture. How do we embed it within the framework of culture? So I'm grateful that we have people who are insightful in connecting all those dots, and that I get to be this little guy who grew up in this little place called called Jamaica, mm-hmm. gets to be a part of that within this context of this amazing institution called Duke University and Duke University Health System.
I am grateful for your leadership in this space. You know, I'm grateful for anybody willing to step up and contribute, you know, to making the culture better. But I am extremely grateful for those individuals who are willing to step, you know, onto the front lines and advocate for us in places that, you know, people at the ground level can't access and can't go. And so, you know, yeah, you're out there helping us, and I'm in service to you, and I'm grateful to be in service to someone who I can entrust.
We're in service
with my efforts.
Yeah, we're in service to each
exactly.
other.
Exactly.
So as I said this in the first impact report that we wrote, and folks haven't seen it, reach out. We can get you a copy of it. And there's a digital version of it as well. Is that I said this in my reflections? Is that I see all of you, every single one of you, and I want folks to be who they truly are. So be you. And I'm going upstairs to get some BU coffee. Because I have had my coffee, Brandon. I see you with your large
I brought my coffee because I didn't know whether or not you were going to bring your coffee.
I said, listen, he's here with coffee and I have no coffee. But I appreciate you so much, Brandon. Thank you.
I appreciate you too, Ian. This is great. And this is actually going to be the first episode of, you know, the second season. It was supposed to be the last episode, but I think it should be the first episode because I think this embodies, you know, what we are doing here right now at Duke as we close out 2024. There's a lot of stuff coming up, or 2023 and going into 2024. Right. And there's a lot of stuff coming up in 2024 that I'm looking forward to because of your leadership.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.
The conversation does not have to stop here. Join us on diversifyit.duke.edu and join our listserv.